Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for June 6th, 2019, the underhanded, undercount edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C., in New Haven at Yale, where she is associated with the Yale Law School, is the New York Times Magazine's Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
And in New York City, at his new office at 60 Minutes, CBS's 60 Minutes, is John Dickerson. How are you?
Hi, David. Actually, I'm in the same recording booth, but I'm...
Oh.
I've just come across the street.
And now afterward, you have to walk across the street?
Exactly. Yeah, I have to dodge cars on 57th Street. It's harrowing.
Oof.
Yeah.
That is harrowing. On this week's GabFest, the Supreme Court gets ready to rule on the big census citizenship case, even as new evidence comes to light of the sneaky racist scheming behind how that citizenship question on the census was born. Then, will the president follow through on his plan to impose new tariffs on Mexico in an effort to get Mexico to change its migration policies? And then, should the Parkland security officer go to prison for his failure to help stop the school massacre at that school in 2018? Plus, of course, we're going to have cocktail chatter. And a reminder that we have two live shows coming up this Saturday. So tomorrow, if you're listening to this on Friday, today, if you're listening to it on Saturday, if you're in New York, there's going to be Slate Day. It's an all-day extravaganza of podcasting in Manhattan, on the High Line, in all sorts of different wonderful forms. There's a Mom and Dad Are Fighting play date. There's a trivia. Nicole Cliff is going to be there. My idol Nicole Cliff is going to be there doing some stuff. There's going to be a wave show. And there's a culture fest. There's a Trump cast. And we, of course, have a show from 2 to 3:30 on Saturday at the SVA Theater in Chelsea. I think we are sold out, but they're all-day passes you can still get, which would allow you access to our show. So if you haven't gotten a ticket to our show, but you want an all-day pass that will get you into our show, there's still plenty available. So go to slate.com/live for tickets to that. And also a reminder that we are doing our first show internationally. We're going to Canada. We're going to Toronto on Wednesday, July 10th at Kerner Hall and the TELUS Center for Performance and Learning. You can go to slate.com/live to get tickets to that show. That is going to be very exciting. We're working on getting a great guest for that show as well. So we'll see you on July 10th in Toronto. This census case is crazy. Secret evidence, an estranged daughter, a shadowy figure who is the Michelangelo of gerrymandering. And meanwhile, the Supreme Court in their back rooms, in their cloistered, becurtained chambers, contemplate a decision which could radically shift not just how we count the census, but how we apportion votes, how we apportion
political power,
how we apportion political power in the country. Emily, what the heck is going on? Who is this fellow Hofeller?
Oh my God! This is like a John Grisham novel had an accident with a Stephen King novel, and Tom Clancy was like at the wheel.
I thought you were gonna add
like
in like SCOTUS blog, like some super wonky co-author.
This would have been better.
A thriller of strange dimensions. So let's just back up for a second. We are talking about the Trump administration's decision to add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census in the face of evidence, very stark conclusions from the Census Bureau itself that adding this question is likely to reduce the accuracy of the census by discouraging and kind of spooking people who are immigrants and people who are networked with immigrants from responding to the census. So the idea is, like, you ask people about their citizenship, if they're not citizens or they live with people who aren't citizens, they're not going to be super excited to tell you all about themselves and give you their home address. Though I should note that it is a violation of federal law to take census data and use it for anything other than its declared purpose. Anyway, lots of roiling around the census, which we've talked about before. And now we have this sort of sixth act in which the daughter of the Michelangelo of gerrymandering, as the New York Times calls him, a man named Thomas Hofeller, her dad died. And then she found on his hard drives a very telling memo he wrote in 2015 in which he said that if you added a citizenship question to the census, Republicans could change the way that states do redistricting. They could base it on this new data about the citizenship population. And that would allow them to redraw districts in a way that help white rural Republican voters. So this citizenship question addition looks like a big power grab. We had some inkling of this before because Chris Kobach, who is the architect of a lot of voter suppression tactics in Kansas, he, we knew, had met with the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross before Ross asked to add the citizenship question. And Kobach had already written for Breitbart about this very same idea of expanding Republican political power based on getting this new data from the census. But now we have this apparent smoking gun because it turns out that Hofeller also helped draft the letter that the Justice Department wrote to Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross, in which it provided this what looks like false justification. Oh, we need this data so we can enforce the Voting Rights Act. There's actually like a word for word paragraph in this letter that is based on a file on Hofeller's hard drive. And so it just, and he was also meeting with this guy, Mark Newman, who was advising Commerce Secretary Ross. There are a lot of dots to connect here. And the kind of underlying question is, okay, it was very hard to believe on its face the Trump administration's professed reason for adding this question in order to better enforce the Voting Rights Act, because this Trump administration has not shown any interest in really helping Black and Hispanic voters through the Voting Rights Act. And the government never asked for this data before to enforce the Voting Rights Act. So it never looked like the real reason. And now we have what looks like real smoking gun evidence that, in fact, it was not. And the big question is whether the Supreme Court is going to care and even pay attention to this at all. And then what does that mean if they're not willing to look behind the curtain?
I mean, isn't it also not just to enhance white power? Didn't he explicitly say, isn't there explicit language, to reduce Hispanic voting power? So that's like that. How much more kind of exactly targeted racist can you be?
Yeah, right. He said it would help Republicans and non-Hispanic whites in his study. Just to add a couple of things to what Emily said. So this fellow Newman was the one working with Hofeller, and basically they said, we don't know where this information came from. We don't know the author. Like what's at stake here is lying also to congressional investigators and also lying to the court. So the first question is whether the Supreme Court, based on this new evidence that the Justice Department and Commerce Department may have lied, there's also a New York case, or is it New York or Maryland? I can't remember. But there are three judges that have not bought the administration's argument. I think either in New York or Maryland, they're trying to get the case reopened, which would then complicate the Supreme Court case, right? Case opened on the idea basically that the administration has been lying about the real reason they're asking the citizenship question, which is what this is now about, which is the administration has said, as you said, it's about voting rights. This suggests that, no, it's about this other thing.
Yeah. In Maryland, I think, or possibly the California case, they're trying to get the case reopened to introduce this evidence. In New York this week, there was a hearing before Judge Jesse Furman, who had presided over a trial on the question of adding the citizenship question. And the hearing was about whether to sanction the lawyers who had let in this false evidence and deal with this possible false testimony. And Judge Furman said he needed more time and briefing and like process to figure that out, and that he wasn't going to make a decision before the Supreme Court is due to rule at the end of June. And so if there had been this hope of like quick movement at the district court level, at least in New York, that could put pressure on the Supreme Court to address this whole question about where this evidence came from and the role it played, that is not going to happen. The Supreme Court is going to have to reach out and find it in another way, which it could completely do if it wants to do that.
So that was the question I wanted to get to. As a matter of Supreme Court practice, is it likely Is it normal for the court to reach out and add evidence which was not introduced at trial, even though the reason it wasn't introduced at trial was perhaps because it was withheld artificially? And do they have any obligation to do that? And knowing what we know of this court, I mean, I'm going to answer this question myself. We're all answering it in our head. Is there any chance they're going to take the Hoffler evidence into account? The answer is, in my head, is no. So just tell
me. Wait, so I mean,
they'll do it on some procedural ground, right? They'll say, like, well, the train has left the station, right? They won't, so that they don't have to wrestle with the...
Tom Clancy drove the car away already. Yeah. The car, Clancy is already out of North Carolina.
Right. Case closed. Like, I wrote the book. I can't add anything to it. But of course, like, that is ridiculous. I mean, no, it's not normal for the Supreme Court to go back and reopen its proceedings, but there's nothing normal about this whole scenario. And when the government presents evidence and then there is new evidence emerging that suggests that the government's presentation was false, then absolutely courts can go back and order a new hearing. They can postpone their own ruling. You know, the Supreme Court could enter like a two-sentence order that just says, like, okay, we're staying our own opinion writing in this case, and we send this back to the district courts to build up the record and get to the bottom of what happened, and we'll see you next term.
There's also a time element here, which is that the census has to go out the door relatively soon to get going, right? So doesn't that add a little bit of drama here in, and just to remind, Emily's already said this, but for people, the reason this is so important is if the census isn't right and you just do the citizen population, you're not counting a lot of people of color who tend to live in Democratic places.
Right.
Right. I mean, yes, absolutely. You're right. I guess I shouldn't have said we'll see you next term. They could just make everyone speed up and deal with this quickly. Like, it is entirely possible for them to take this new evidence into account if they choose to do so. But I think David's right. Like, we all think the ideological makeup of the court makes that extremely unlikely. And then, like, where are we? I mean, there's a way in which this case is like the travel ban case, but it's also worse because the travel ban, by the time the Supreme Court approved it, it had at least the fig leaf that the Trump administration had to go back twice and then three times and revise its travel ban and make it look like a proper government rulemaking process. This time we've had zero of that. And so, you know, it's the Trump administration is forcing the Supreme Court to basically like paper over these really glaring procedural problems with the kind of fig leaf of like, oh, case closed. We're not going to look at this anymore. Like, we just accept on its face the government's rationale for adding the citizenship question, no matter how implausible. And that just sort of strains people's faith in courts and in law.
Roberts and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh all to me seem to be people who they are less outcome oriented perhaps than Alito and Thomas are. They do seem to care about process and that people don't lie to courts and that courts are trusted authorities and that rules are followed. And it's surprising to me that they would be willing to tolerate so much dishonesty, so much deception, like a complete and obviously an obvious utter lie that the government has told about why they're doing this particular thing. And then the government not abiding by procedures that it says it has to abide by in order to put a question like this down on the census. And so I would have thought there'd be some way in which at least Roberts and maybe, as I said, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch would be quite bothered by that and might stand up against something like that. But yet I don't think they will.
Yeah, I don't think we have a whole lot of evidence that when there's real political power at stake, that those three justices put procedural principles, the ones you were just talking about, ahead of that chance to increase Republican political power. And I guess I'm thinking particularly of Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in the Shelby County Voting Rights Act case, where, you know, if you read his opinion for the majority, and this is like a big 5-4 conservatives versus liberal split, he says things have changed dramatically in the South. Like, we don't need this prophylactic part of the Voting Rights Act anymore that prevented states from changing their voting rules and doing things like closing polling places unless they had the approval of the Justice Department. And it just isn't an opinion that stacks up against reality. Like, the states then went and made a couple of thousand different changes to their rules. And so I just don't really buy it.
I'm going to argue with you about that. But that was – I thought he obviously wrong. Obviously what has happened is exactly the opposite of what they said was going to happen.
But that's
I think that's – I don't think that's post hoc reasoning.
But
I mean,
there was a
afterwards.
Lot of evidence beforehand.
He didn't definitively know
that all those things would happen. But there was evidence beforehand that the states were trying to do things that, like, absolutely were going to have that effect. And the Justice Department was repeatedly blocking them from doing that. So the notion that, like, they would stop. I mean, right. This is the case in which Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent says, like, when it's raining outside and your umbrella is keeping you dry, you don't close it and expect not to get wet. Right. Like, he did have warning.
But David's point, I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but David's point is that in this case, there is an interest being trampled that Roberts would seem to care about. Whereas was that really the case in Shelby? In other words, what you seem to be arguing, Emily, is he just made the wrong call there. And there was plenty of evidence for why he should have made the right call. In this case, it seems that because I sort of agree with what David's saying, is that in this case, not only did they not follow the proper procedure the first go round here, we now have pretty strong evidence that they also lied in a court of law, they being the administration, and that Roberts would seem to have, and I don't know about the other two, would seem to have some interest in people kind of playing by the rules as one of his core principles. And that's why doing the thing that would increase conservative power would run up against a more core principle than with Shelby. But maybe I don't remember Shelby right.
Well, I mean, another reason I think that Shelby also in its different own way was about playing by the rules is that Congress had just reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. And the Supreme Court normally defers to legislation like that and to legislative findings about the need for a law of that sort. And yet, like, the conservatives, didn't uphold that principle in that particular case. I think the analogy with the travel ban and the census case is closer because we're talking about the power of the executive branch through a federal agency. And so you're right. Like, we want to hold out this notion that there are these principles about how agencies make rules and they're politically neutral and judges of all ideological stripes should care about them. But I don't think the travel ban decision really bears out that notion, since it had its own 5-4 conservative versus liberal split. And, we'll see with this one.
I want to move us on to the sort of why this citizenship question came to be. One purpose of it is just seems to be maybe a pure undercount. And there's estimates that this would reduce the Black and Hispanic census count by 4 million people in the 2020 census. That's a pretty conservative estimate, but that's a huge number of people, and that would have ripple effects. But the other reason is that it would allow the government to now know how many citizens are in each state, each congressional district, each county. And therefore, if you wanted to have a law that allowed apportionment to be based on the number of citizens, you could now do it because you would now have good data. So my question to one of you, probably to you, Emily, since you are the legal eagle on this, what does it take to move from gathering this data on citizenship to states actually being able to use that to only count citizens for the purposes of apportionment for either federal or state elections? Can they just go ahead and do this, or do they need to take other steps before they can go ahead and just say, we're only going to count citizens?
There is nothing to stop states from changing the way they apportion to the citizen-based population for state elections. The Supreme Court ruled in this 2015 case called Evanwell versus Abbott that the states didn't have to do that. They could keep doing it the way they've always done, which is just like people, not citizens. But they didn't shut the door to a state trying to change this practice. And so I think that once this data is collected, you can expect some Republican-leaning states to try this out. It's hard to imagine, again, that the Supreme Court would stop them.
Can
but
I ask you a question?
That is not for federal elections.
Right. Federal elections have a different rule because one person, one vote really means one person, one vote in the Constitution. States have to use the total population count, not the citizenship count. That comes from the words in the 14th Amendment.
Couldn't somebody who feels that they have not gotten a benefit because the distribution of benefits is tied to a bad count sue and use this material, the Hoffler material, in their lawsuit for arguing why. Or you could just argue, let's say we change the makeup of congressional districts and a state loses, particularly a blue state, loses a member. Could they use this then as grounds, and this new evidence as grounds to launch legal proceedings, and you wouldn't have the problem that the Supreme Court is likely to grab here, which is, you know, the train's already left the station. We wrote our opinion. You know, we had our debate, had our opinion. We've written our opinions.
Yeah.
Well, but the census data will have been, I mean, I think once you've gathered the census data, the data exists. You can't sort of pretend it doesn't exist.
Well, right. But couldn't you as a state say the data exists, but the data is faulty, and based on this faulty data, you're taking away a member of Congress, and that shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's going to we'll have those challenges. States have definitely mounted those challenges before. They generally lose, though.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me, Emily, that you think that we're likely to see this done for state elections. So a state like Mississippi or Louisiana or Texas is going to say, we're only, for the purposes of apportioning our state legislature, we're only going to count how many citizens live in a district.
Right. I mean, this goes back to Hoffeller's study in 2015. Like, this was legal after the Supreme Court's decision in Evanwell. And the thing that was standing between states trying this and actually doing it was a lack of complete census data. So now you've checked that box. Why wouldn't the states try to do that?
What do you guys think? I actually find myself oddly ambivalent about this, and I know I'm wrong. And constitutionally, of course, it says one person, one vote. But what is the argument against just counting citizens for the purpose of apportionment? Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I don't think that there's necessarily like an incredibly great argument against that.
Well, okay. So first of all, it's citizens of voting age. So you go back to this principle.
Why should it be citizens of voting age? Shouldn't it just be citizens?
That's what everybody talks about. It's called the citizen voting age population is what they would use, which leaves out children, right? I mean, I suppose you could include
Right. Well, I don't approve that. I would say you'd include
but look,
the children.
When you're so imagine like you're a state legislator. Do you represent the immigrants and foreign-born people who are not citizens who are in your district? Like there they are. They are human beings. They also have needs and wants and rights. And so the idea is like you don't care about them because like they're not counted in the sense of representation, right? Like that's has to be the principle if you're going to change this.
But they still live in your district. But they still live in your district,
yeah,
they don't have the capacity to vote for you anyway. So your ability to represent them is no different than it was before. It's simply
right,
a matter of counting.
The principle of disenfranchising them means that you basically, this government is saying, like, these people
But you're not
don't
disenfranchising
count.
Them. They're not enfranchised because they are not citizens. They haven't
well,
been disenfranchised.
They're
just not franchised.
You're right. They didn't have the vote before, but you're taking away any notion that they count, right, in the course of representation. And so I think that idea, to me, there's something noxious about it.
Well, what imagine, and I don't think that you have a scenario like this, but imagine you had a district, you had a place where there was literally every single person that lived there was an immigrant.
A non-citizen
immigrant.
Then nobody can vote, and then you don't have a district like that.
Well, you could, no, the district would exist. Nobody would vote. Like, nobody could get elected. There would be no votes. But why should that just – that's an absurd situation to imagine, right? It's ludicrous. It shouldn't happen.
Yeah, but it also doesn't happen. Like, isn't that one of those, like, you can create a hypothetical in which, like, yes, if we ever reached that place, it would be crazy. But, like, that's not the world we live in. So who cares?
Can I just weigh in? And I think it's true that we have about somewhere between 13 and 14 million lawful permanent residents, which is the class we're talking. I mean, one portion of the class we're talking about here, people who are.
Yeah. What about them?
In the country legally, but not citizens, which is distinct from people who are in the country not legally. So that's another group. But hey, can I just ask one more legal question of you, Emily, which is what is the grounds on which the Supreme Court conservatives would judge in favor of the administration? What would they hang their argument on, since three lower courts have said that the administration can't do this?
Yeah. So the legal claim here, the main one is under the Administrative Procedures Act. And the argument is that the Trump administration screwed this up so badly that its rulemaking in adding the citizenship question, it was arbitrary and capricious. That's the legal standard. So the Supreme Court just says, like, no, it wasn't. We believe them. Sure, this could be to enforce the Voting Rights Act better. Like, they say that's what they're doing. That's must be what they're doing. Like, case closed. You know, normally the government wins cases where they're changing the rules under the Administrative Procedure Act because you just, like, follow a set of procedures and it's not that hard to do.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the GabFest, other Slate podcasts. So today's Slate Plus segment, we're going to discuss the protests against President Trump during his visit to Great Britain. And is it good or bad when foreigners deride and mock and protest an American president visiting their country? Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today and hear that discussion and other Slate Plus bonus discussions.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu.
This week, Mexican and American negotiators have been trying to resolve the latest Trump trade/immigration crisis, the president has declared he's going to impose a 5% tariff on all Mexican trade if Mexico doesn't tighten up its own migration policies, if it doesn't keep asylum seekers in Mexico, if it doesn't control Mexico's southern border to prevent the flow of Central American migrants, if it doesn't stop the migrant caravans from making their way across Mexico. The president also says the tariffs will increase every month up to 25% if Mexico doesn't meet these demands. There's been a lot of pushback from the Republican Party. John, Mexico has sent its negotiators very quickly. And, you know, clearly, I don't think anyone in who has a economic interest in Mexico particularly wants these tariffs to happen. But so far, at the time of our taping on Thursday morning, they don't seem to have had the breakthrough that has satisfied President Trump or Vice President Pence. So is this a madman approach by Trump that could work, that could, you know, compel Mexico to make some serious changes in the migration policies that they wouldn't otherwise make in order to forestall these tariffs?
I don't know, but I think there's evidence I think you could make that case. I mean, I guess the first thing is one of the articles that I read talked about, you know, the purported crisis of unlawful immigration across the border. Last month was the largest month in 7 years of migrants being arrested at the border, which was up 32% from April. So, like, this isn't a non-problem. That's distinct from the question of whether you need to send the military and need to do these tariffs. But it's not a non-problem. Now, and it's also distinct from whether the remedies being put in place, tariffs and others, a wall and so forth, actually do anything to meet the problem. In terms of whether this is the madman theory, I mean, I think I've tried this theory out before, but is essentially that on some things, I wonder whether the president doesn't have a kind of Munchausen by proxy approach to governing, which is creates a crisis, creates a dust up, and then a bunch of people scramble around and do things to fix the crisis that he's created. In this case, the crisis is increased cost of consumer goods for U.S. Consumers, which, based on some studies, Mexico plus what's happening in China plus, is already eating away at and will have eaten away at the benefit lower and middle income people got from the tax cut, hurting people at the lowest income portion of the income scale more than anybody else. So the creates all this crisis. Some kind of solution is found. The president says, see what I did? Solved it. Even though the progress in some cases is merely reasserting the status quo that was there before the crisis happened. I also think that the president, going back to my elevator analogy, I think he wants to push the buttons that he can push. And in this case, this is something he can do to this issue. the open question, I would say one other thing. If the Fed is really thinking about cutting rates, that's another thing the president wanted them to do. He was said they were crazy to raise rates. Now they're talking about lowering rates in order to deal with this tariff madness. So you could imagine him saying, see, I got the agreement with Mexico and I got the Fed to lower rates, which I'd been trying to do because it was killing our economic growth. So those are some thoughts in response to your madman theory. This is, one should obviously say, no way to run a railroad. And during the Obama administration, so often he was attacked for the lack of certainty that he that his policies were creating in the business world and in the markets. And I mean, obviously, this is a huge dose and constant dose of uncertainty from the president.
Emily, there's been actual pushback from Republican senators who are irate about the prospect of tariffs. They think it's the wrong mechanism, that it's effectively a tax on American consumers and American firms. And theoretically, if Republican senators oppose these tariffs, it's a veto proof. If they can also round up some House Republicans, you could have a veto proof group in both houses of Congress that could stop the president from doing this.
And yet,
we also know that will never happen. Yeah, right. They will not fall into line, or they will fall into line when the time comes, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there is a spectacle aspect of this, which is to watch the Republican Party, which I thought was a party of free trade, become so willing to totally throw a monkey wrench into free trade. And I feel like one thing about tariffs is the longer term implications of them, because they disrupt all these cross border markets that the companies have put enormous work into building, right? So like these supply chains where you make part of something and then you send it to Mexico and they make part of something and you send it back to America. And like, that's how we make cars and that's how we make a million different things. If we're really going to put a big cost on doing business that way, that is going to just have all kinds of ripple effects. I mean, obviously, we could have this conversation about China too, but Mexico, like our closest neighbor and like seamless trading partner in the wake of NAFTA, like this is a big deal. And I don't really feel we know how that all plays out.
Right. But I'm generally an avid free trader. And so it's easier for me to make the argument you just made than I think it is for you to make it, Emily. Why is it so wrong to throw a wrench in global trade to get policy gains on something that is a different matter? If you believe that the migration crisis is a real crisis, and if you want to put pressure on the Mexican government, you don't want to go to war with Mexico. You don't want to send troops to Mexico. You don't want to bomb Mexico. You don't want to murder migrants. I mean, maybe this administration does. But why put free trade on this pedestal where we can't possibly disrupt these supply chains? These supply chains are much more important than anything
else.
Well,
we care about being...
Why is this not a legitimate use? I mean, there's a question of whether the president actually has the authority to do it. But why is it not legitimate to say, okay, free trade is one of the mechanisms that we have to put pressure on other countries for policy matters that we really care about? So let's use it.
I mean, I think we generally don't, because we like the idea of America becoming wealthier and more important in the global economy rather than walled off from it. And those have been pretty sacrosanct political principles. But I also think your argument made much more sense in the context of China, where you're using trade policy to address problems of trade policy, right? Like the Chinese are stealing all this intellectual property. And they really are doing things to prop up their own industries. So at least tariffs feel like they're apples responding to apples, even if it's still a misguided idea. Whereas like the Mexicans aren't to blame for the instability in countries like Guatemala that are sending in, from which people are fleeing because of violence there. And the notion that Mexico, a much poorer country in the United States, is supposed to just like stop all these people or hold on to all these people, like it just seems so a problem where the problem and this tariff solution do not align.
Another thing I would add, I'm susceptible to your argument, David, because we use embargoes and economic threats to countries all the time to get them to do other things that we want. So this seems in keeping with that. But the president's not being straight with what's going on here. I mean, he's claiming that these tariffs are going to bring money into the U.S. the same way he's claiming the same thing with China. And he's being contradicted in public by his economic officials, let alone every other breathing economist on the planet. And nevertheless, he continues to say things in support of this policy that are not true. So that's not good. You should be able to argue for this policy on its own terms, not have to lie and spin to do it. And the second reason you don't, you maybe don't want to do it, is that you're bonking on the head the very, I mean, at least based on the analysis of the Tax Foundation and the University of Pennsylvania, the tariffs that the president has enacted so far are hurting the people that he devoted his inaugural address to, the forgotten man. So the people at the lower and middle fifth of the income scale. Now, you could make the case, hey, a little shared sacrifice so that we can straighten these things out. Problem is, on the case of in the case of China, straightening out means fixing the intellectual property right arrangements. And that helps
coastal
pharmaceutical industries and the pharmaceutical corporations. So the question is whether even in the corrected balance of trade the president would like, whether the rewards would flow to the voters that he says he's in there swinging for.
Emily, do you think there's a way in which the strong economy has just protected Trump from the consequences of all of these various wild swings and variegations on trade?
Yeah, I do think that's true. I also think the parts of the country that are hardest hit, you know, some of the farmers who've been hit, they're in like deep Trump country in which it's hard to get people to shift their allegiances when they were based on so many sort of like cultural or deep feelings of alienation mm-hmm. from Democrats as well as affinity for Trump. Then the other thing is, like, if the Fed is going to shield Trump and the country from the consequences, then that is also going to put off implications of all of this. And I just feel like there is a way in which Trump makes a lot of moves that if you cared about the medium or the long term, you would not make. But he doesn't care about the medium or the long term at all. Like, he won't be in office when we pay the price.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Scott Peterson, the resource officer, the cop, the security guard at Parkland, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School in Florida, was charged with 11 felony counts this week. 10 of them related to sort of neglect, his failure to provide care to the children under his care. And the way in which he failed to do that is when there was this terrible attack by a school shooter. In 2018, Peterson stood outside the school, never entered, never attempted to stop the shooter, never moved to save any of the children or put his own life at risk. And he is now facing, I think, life in prison, actually.
I think up to 100 years, I think.
It's some crazy sentence.
If convicted. So it's a really complicated case and a really complicated issue because obviously the villain, there's one villain in this case. It is the
shooter.
Murderer who came and slaughtered his classmates. And Peterson is not that person. Peterson, you know, was apparently a coward or confused in the moment. And the question is whether it is useful, whether it is valuable, whether it is right to hold him criminally accountable for a terrible mistake that he's made and a sin, perhaps, that he's committed. So, Emily, I want to start with you. Does it make sense to you that there have been criminal charges filed against Peterson?
Not really. I mean, for one thing, I understand the impulse to blame him, and I do think he behaved in a pretty indefensible manner. But I just feel like this is what we do, right? Like, we pick one person and we scapegoat them instead of coming up with some solution that is more likely to prevent future terrible shootings, like having more restrictions on gun ownership. And so it just upsets me that, like, this is the consequence and the kind of, like, thing we can hold up. Like, oh, we did this. We put this one cowardly police officer in prison for a long time instead of, like, really changing the underlying conditions that informed what happened here. I guess you can argue that this is a wake-up call for other cops in this position, and it will be easier for police officers in the moment to remember that a dereliction of duty can have serious consequences. I really think, though, this prosecution is not going to work. The statutes that he's being charged under, they're not meant for cops. They're, like, about neglecting kids. Like, usually duties that we associate and put on to parents, not the police.
But Emily, it's also the case, you know, you can't have I think it would be very bad to have a system where police officers or the military, where if you don't do your job, where if your job is to protect people and you just, like, hey, I'm not going to do it, that there's no responsibility.
But it's not that there's no responsibility.
I mean,
in the military, right? Like, there's I hate this idea that the only consequence is putting someone in prison and criminally prosecuting them. Like, there are other consequences.
Right. In the military, though, this ends puts you in the brig. You can get desertion. You get hanged for desertion, you know, historically.
Yeah, well, do we want to treat people who are in law enforcement inside the country and are not in the military as if they're in the military?
I don't know. John, does this solution feel, or this remedy feel like a useful piece of a remedy?
No. Well, no. I mean, for a version of the reasons that Emily cites, which is that the complexity here goes beyond whatever you may feel about guns and gun rights. I mean, there were 18 calls warning about the shooter. The FBI admitted that they ignored real tips about the shooter. And then there was... Maybe it's just the fog of the moment, but the initial response from the other responding officers was not seamlessly perfect in all ways in communication and so forth. So, and I don't know enough about the training to, because I know, and I, so I don't know enough about training to make a claim here, period. However, I do know, and again, I don't know if that's the case in here, but that the training has changed in terms of how you respond to these. I mean, that I think that the view now is that you rush in and you go in and you don't wait and you, but that there was a period in which the response to school shooters was to wait. Again, I have no idea if that's the case here, but it does. But I say all of that to how Peterson was trained matters too. What we would all want is some kind of sanction for somebody who doesn't just do their job poorly, but who does the opposite of their job. And as a result, you know, more people are killed. In this case, we're really talking about the students and teachers who were killed on the third floor, because the ones on the first floor, I think it was 11 of the 17, it was over almost instantaneously. Nobody could have done. There was no resource officer who could have done anything. But the claims here are about, you know, what could have happened on the third floor after which you know, might have been possible. I also, there's also the question of whether he lied about his response and what it was. And that obviously we don't want in any situation separate and apart from the bravery question.
It is, I think, Emily, your point that this is a classic example of the scapegoat is really useful. The idea of a scapegoat in the Bible is that this is a creature on which you put all of everyone's sins and then send this goat off into the wilderness to die. Peterson is not exactly this, because Peterson clearly bears some sort of culpability. There's some way in which he failed in his duty. But the notion that prosecuting him solves these deeper structural problems, the one John just identified around the warnings about the shooter, the fact that guns are so readily available to people, the fact that we have a culture where school shootings are familiar and thus are viral. They're contagious, and so it makes it much easier for people to do school shootings. Mentally, it's easier to do it. I mean, all of those things allow us to avoid our own culpability, our own responsibility for these shootings, which is that we have failed to create an environment where children can be safe because we are unwilling to attack these other issues and unwilling to do harder things, politically harder things, in order to make ourselves and our children safer. The one argument against that in this case is that Florida did pass some new gun safety laws. It did pass laws around arming teachers. It did pass laws or changed how police are supposed to respond to it. So it's not this is not the only thing that Florida is doing in response to the Parkland shooting. You could say that they actually are pursuing this kind of mosaic approach, and that yes, Peterson is a scapegoat, but it's not the only act of reflection and action that Florida's taking.
Yeah, I think all of that context is really important. And then there's just this question about whether this single prosecution will have the kind of effect on other police officers that would make you see that, like, oh, some good can come of it. And then there's just this sort of pure question of retribution, right? I mean, there are parents of the kids who died who are saying, like, may this person rot in hell. And you can understand if you felt like someone had the duty to protect your child and could have saved your child's mm-hmm. life and just, like, stood there quaking, that would feel like something you wanted revenge for. I wonder, though, about taking the energy. There's been such amazing energy from the Parkland students in particular and some of these families, and then channeling it into, like, revenge-filled trial and criminal proceeding. I just wonder about the good that that's going to do.
Just to make one small point, and then, John, you can have a last word on this, but I don't think there's an epidemic of cowardly police officers or cowardly school security officers. This is not a problem that we have that we're now going to solve by prosecuting Peterson. Like, what's remarkable is how brave
people have been.
People of all kinds are. I mean, teachers have been, children have been, police officers have been. It's astonishing how brave people are. And so this is not an epidemic.
Right. And in the last few months, we've had a couple of students who have rushed shooters and died in the course of trying to protect their classmates.
The hero movement is really interesting because you see it in the way the media and the police are dealing with these shootings as well, which is that the police in Virginia Beach, after the recent shooting there, said they were only going to mention the shooter's name once and never more. And the media that covers and overcovers these shootings has, it feels like over the last couple of years, maybe last year, turned from obsessing about the shooter to spending more time talking about the heroes and the victims. And I'm fascinated what that will do to change the appetite and the obvious search for kind of a weird kind of fame from the people who engage in these shootings. And on your point, David, that's why police and first responders are so amazing, is that this is what they sign up for. They and we all used to think about it in terms of 9/11, but they sign up for when everything awful in the world is happening and everybody's running out of a building, they run in. It feels like that still happens all the time, and that this is an actual, like, a major aberration that doesn't need a punitive remedy for the purposes of educating others.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are having a summer drink, a summer cocktail, beginning of summer, summer solstice cocktail, Emily Bazelon, what are you going to be chattering about?
So some GabFest listeners know the main character in my podcast that was based on my book, Charged, is a young man in Brooklyn named Terrari. And I got an amazing text from him this morning, amazing for him, amazing in the world, that he just signed up for classes at St. Francis College in Brooklyn for the fall and got what looks like a nice, healthy financial aid award to go to school. So I'm just feeling really excited and thrilled for Terrari that he's taking that next step, and I can't wait to support and encourage him in pursuing his education.
That's wonderful.
Jean Valjean, what is your chatter?
Mine is about a new Pew poll about which I'm not sure what I think. But anyway, it's about the idea of what they call made-up news. So 50% of the country, 50% of those surveyed said made up news is a very big problem in the country today. That's ahead of violent crime, racism, illegal immigration, terrorism, and climate change. So my reaction to this is, what are your terms and what are we? And one of the things that I think has been a problem with the term fake news is that the president has been able to successfully, he's able to use the idea that some news is wrong and incorrect and make basically fake news apply to anything he just doesn't like. So it can be 100% verifiable, but he'll call it fake news. And that we in the culture have kind of lapsed into that. People use the term fake news now all the time, which means they're doing his work for him. And by his work in this specific instance, I mean changing the definition of what news is and basically making news equal anything that Donald Trump doesn't like. And so I feel like this is also being picked up in this survey, which found that those people who think that made-up news is a problem, who do they blame? 57% blame political leaders. So that seems like a category mistake because political leaders aren't involved in news. They're not. So to say that they are muddies the water and therefore allows anybody who wants to make journalism where people care about facts and get in trouble if they don't have their facts right, it kind of lumps that in with anybody who's just riffing about information. And so I think this is a huge problem that even though people and that people should hold politicians to account for spreading information that's untrue. But what does this poll show? The percentage of adults who say what group has the most responsibility in reducing the amount of made up news, not the politicians who are saying stuff that ain't true, but a respondent said 53%. So the largest by a huge margin is that the news media is responsible for making this up. So that also seems to me to be a problem. You should hold people to account who say the stuff that ain't true, and that's the end of that.
All right, my chatter is about two stories, related stories, dismal fucking stories. So there's so many problems with what the Trump administration is doing with migrants who are appearing at our borders, and there are so many like legitimate discussions about what the proper kind of policy response. But as we learned with the children in cages and family separation policies that the administration pursued. Once somebody is in your care, you have an obligation to care for them, and especially if that person is vulnerable, either because they're sick or old or weak or young. And there were two stories this week that really depressed me. One is the news that the Trump administration is canceling almost everything that makes life tolerable for young migrants, child migrants in U.S. shelters. So English classes, legal aid for unaccompanied child migrants, soccer and other recreation, basically are saying we only have money to do food and shelter, and that's it. And it's like that is not sufficient. That's not sufficient. If you have these children under your care, you have to do more than simply give them food and shelter. You have to find a way to make their life tolerable and keep them in progress. And then there's a second story that was in Yahoo News about the very strong evidence that Border Patrol is confiscating medicine that people are bringing over the border, necessary medicine, and then not replacing it. So typical policy is if you come over the border with medicine, you explain this to a doctor, an American doctor, and that American doctor then issues you a new prescription to ensure that your medicine, your necessary medicine, continues. And this is to, you know, prevent some plague of people bringing in illegal drugs or something. I mean, I think it's a ludicrous thing they're preventing against, but at least understand the idea that, okay, you don't want people to bring in ersatz medicine or drugs under the cover of medicine. That's fine. But you have to then give the child their seizure medicine, give the adult their diabetes medicine, give the person their blood pressure medicine. And it appears that what's happening is these meds are being confiscated and then people are not getting any medicine in return, and so they're living on a knife's edge. And that's monstrous and immoral, and we should be ashamed that the government is doing that. So there's that. I also, of course, want to talk about listener chatter because we've gotten lots of really great listener chatters from you. Please keep them coming. Please tweet them to us at Slate Gabfest or email us at gabfest@slate.com with your listener chatter or put them on the Facebook page. This one comes from at JD Rannyman, Starbuck and Ripley Forever. I don't know what that Starbuck and Ripley Forever is, but whatever it is. And Starbuck and Ripley Forever says, for all the hand-wringing about social media, we forget the benefits of modern technologies, and a link to a story about how the collapsing crime rates of the 90s might have been driven by cell phones. And this very interesting story, which was in The Atlantic, about how the arrival of cell phones seems to have diminished gang violence because there was less fighting over territory. That once cell phones arrived, drug dealing became less territorial than it had been, and so there was less need to fight about it. And therefore, there was just a diminishment in violence. And that's, you know, that's good news. That's all right. That's nice. Anyway, interesting story. So please send us your cocktail chatter ideas by tweeting to us at SlateGabFest. Also, I just want to welcome some new Slate Plus members. Shelley Hutchins from Farmington, North Carolina. Welcome. Kathleen Evans from St. Louis, Missouri. Howdy, Kathleen. Tanya, no last name, from South Bend, Indiana. Hi, Tanya. Beth Miller from Philadelphia, PA. I'm sure you'll run into Emily on the street one of these days, Beth. Keita Mazur from Los Angeles, California. How you doing, Keita? Thanks for joining Slate Plus. That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. June Thomas is our managing producer for Slate Audio, and Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Audio. Thanks to Alan Pang, Danielle Hewitt, and Ryan McAvoy for engineering today's show. You should follow us on Twitter at SlateGabFest. For Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll see some of you on Saturday in New York for our Slate Day live show. And we'll talk to the rest of you all next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? There were Brits by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, protesting President Trump's visit to the United Kingdom this week. The president called those protests fake news, even though they were very real. They existed. There was a huge baby Trump balloon. Trump as a kind of crying, hysterical baby, a blimp of Trump. There was a Duchess who did some side eye at the Trumps. There was a lot of mockery of the Trumps' poor tailoring of their morning coats. Is it good, John? Is it a positive sign for the world when the president of the United States goes abroad and is met with derision and protest?
Well, I don't know if it's a positive sign for the world. My preference would be that it was on policy issues. And there's a bit of a tradition of protest when American presidents particularly go to Great Britain. In 84, they protested Reagan for the buildup of missiles in Europe.
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.